That process has been going on in us, in our ancestors and their ancestors, for millennia. One of the greatly pleasing things I do is go with traveling groups to the south of France to visit the prehistoric caves and look at the art that's there. I think I may have been there 4 times by now, and it never ceases to be new every time. To walk into a cave and look at a pair of magnificent horses on the wall, standing as horses do, you know, head to rump, and realize that, those paintings have been dated to 25,000 years before the present. And underneath each horse is a little outline of a human hand. It's kind of a signature. But there's nowhere in the caves I've visited that I've ever seen a human representation. What I do see is exceedingly beautiful and expert renditions of the forms of animals. The closest that one gets, in the places I've been, to human representation is in an occasional representation of the female sexual genital region. Just that, on the wall. Now, that's not pornography, I think. My own view is that that is a devotion to the goddess. Well, so this activity in the human psyche, you know, 25,000 years ago finds people on the globe who are the same as we are, essentially, in their essential construction. So the first kind of thinking, which he calls directed or logical thinking, operates with speech elements. This is Jung himself. I'm going to let him speak right now. The former operates with speech elements for the purpose of communication, and it's difficult and exhausting. The latter is effortless, working, as it were, spontaneously. You don't have to cause this kind of thinking, that is, the non-directed, associative, world-building kind of thinking. You don't have to struggle with that and make that happen. The thing one has to learn to do is to not obstruct it, to clear the way for it, and it operates spontaneously. With the contents that are at hand and the personality at hand, and it's guided by unconscious motives. This first kind of thinking produces innovations, science and technology, and adaptation. Everybody can have an iPhone. It copies reality, and it tries to act on it. Jung, still Jung. The other way turns away from objective reality and sets free subjective tendencies. And as regards adaptation, it's unproductive. It's not about adaptation. It's not about learning how to live in the world and making new things for living better in the world. It's about becoming more and more human, it seems to me, whatever that might mean in any particular era. Now, this second type of thinking, associative, I think that's a typo, associative thinking or symbolic thinking seems to have been the mode of humans for a very long time in our history. At critical times, the first type, directed, non-associative, rational thinking, has appeared in our human story with varying results. I'm not going to stop to say what I mean by varying results. But when humans try to make the world according to the constructions that we make with the rational mind, sometimes very good things happen. Sometimes very bad things happen. I would dare say the Holocaust was one example of a construction with a rational mind, although a great deal of irrationality was involved. Now, I want to talk a little bit about something that happened maybe 400 years ago or so, because it's very material to the situation we find ourselves in now with respect to these two ways of thinking, because they're both alive now and in our world. I dare say directed thinking has become very dominant. in a group like this, particularly a Quaker group, and a group interested in depth psychology, my feeling is that this is a small island of souls who want to see the other kind of thinking honored and practiced as much as we can learn how to not obstruct it. And in a certain sense, the meeting for worship is such a place. In the European Renaissance, spanning the 15th and 16th centuries, it was as if a whole civilization woke up to a vast range of possibilities. Possibilities for collective and individual life that had formerly been the psychic domain of a few avant-garde, the Ibn Arabis of the day. Only a few people began to know what happened. It was a revolution in epistemology. That is, a revolution in the science of knowing, of knowledge, the forms and shapes and conditions of knowledge. This was the European Renaissance, still like a bell ringing in our own civilization. Because suddenly, almost suddenly, in about 1600, Francis Bacon published the Novum Organum, the new order of knowledge and study, particularly for the universities. In that day, it was generally true that if you wanted to go to a university and study higher knowledge, you had to sign a pledge originated in the church that you would hew to and protect and honor the teachings of Aristotle in everything that you did. Because Aristotle's philosophy and Christian doctrine had been united by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. So you had to sign that pledge if you wanted to be admitted to university. We didn't want anybody there thinking and coloring outside the lines. Yes, we do chuckle at that. How could they have done that? Well, they did that out of as much wisdom as they could accumulate to protect the faith, for one thing. And to be sure that the thinking that went on around it was safe and hygienic. But suddenly, on a historical scale, that is, whole new libraries of human thought and discovery that had lain under a pall of centuries were discovered, translated, and spread out for all to read. Much that had been developed through classical Greek civilization had been devastated by the wars and political difficulties in the West. And here's an irony for you. You know who saved Greek culture and civilization for the West to discover? The Arabs. Isn't that ironic? It's a great story. Creative artists of all kinds offered incredible arrays of expressive imagery. New music was heard in the cathedrals, and those cathedrals were built for that music, were they not? Polyphonic music is built and constructed so that it will resonate up over the altar, down the apse, all the way back to the entrance, and come down and enfold the congregation in this marvelous sound. And it would not be long before the new physical scientists were opening the secret books of nature to astronomical, chemical, and physical understanding. And that happened in historical terms, boom, like a flash of a bright light. The human spirit broke out of a long, drowsy time into the brilliant light of new possibility. That was the Renaissance. And when we say enlightenment, that's what we're generally thinking of, that time, that place. And we think not only of Francis Bacon, who reconstructed the whole epistemology of higher learning with a single publication. We think of people like Voltaire, Rousseau in France, Diderot, the encyclopedia maker, and others of that generation of people. Rushing into this new construction, new ways of constructing the world. We tend to think if we're a little bit careless, we tend to think that that's the only time such a thing happened. And that was in already the 16th century. But it's not the first time. That happened once before. In the modern country of Turkey, which was then under Greek control, in the province of Ionia, in the city of Miletus. Miletus is not far from Ephesus, where Paul had his work to do a bit later. But a similar shift in the human thought process, and now called the Ionian Enlightenment, had occurred much earlier than the European Renaissance, near the beginning of the 6th century BCE. That's in the 500s before the era of the present day, the common era, so-called. And the Ionian Enlightenment was really very interesting. It started with what were called the pre-Socratic philosophers, most of whom belonged to this cultural sphere of classical Greek influence. These men, I must say again, patriarchy is very strong in that part of the world and in that time of history. To find women scientists who made large contributions to Renaissance in their own place, you have to go to Egypt. Go to the city of Alexandria, where you find a woman. Will I remember her name? Here comes the plague again. I will, but later. A brilliant teacher and researcher. She worked in Alexandria. She was a Christian. Alexandria at that time was rife with mobs of every kind. Religious mobs in the streets, Jewish mobs, anti-Jewish mobs, anti-Christian mobs. Alexandria was a dangerous place, but she taught modern science in Alexandria in a period, maybe in the 2nd century or the 1st BCE. So you see, this opening of the mind occurred a long time ago in Ionia, and it led to a group of philosophers who began to think about the natural world and began to get the idea that you cannot really know or describe the natural world properly with mythological language. The mythopoetic frame of mind is not situated and not constructed to look at the microscopic structure and character of the created world. And what was happening was the invention and elaboration of a new kind of thinking. You can almost hear the human mind growing by leaps and bounds in what it thought was possible, and in the ways it devised to realize the possible. These people included a philosopher by the name of Thales. Thales got to thinking, why is there something and not nothing? And what's the world made of? And his conclusion was, because water is so universal in human experience, that's the basic element of construction. All natural physical reality is constructed from water. Well, it turned out to be wrong. But as a leap of imagination and mental reality-based, or I don't want to say that, I mean directed kinds of thinking, it was a triumph. We have a theory about the physical structure of the world that our mind constructs every day as we walk through it. He laid the foundation for later natural science. Everyone who studies chemistry from the start at university level, maybe high school these days, I don't know, maybe middle school, learns about Thales and Anaximander, Anaxagoras. These were people who were grappling with these very basic constructions of the world. And when I think about them, I imagine the excitement they had. Just how terrifically exciting that world must have been at that time. But this Ionian Enlightenment, although it no doubt substantially contributed to the development of classical civilization, did not last It was the victim of military and political unrest in that part of then Greece, and it basically disappeared, except in a few writings. Until that spectacular chapter in Europe that I just referred to opened. I've described some of the people who made a contribution in that. That really is worth your time to go and read again in the what I will call the dynamics, the psychological dynamics of Renaissance. In thinking about psychological rebirth and rebuilding and the formation of new psychic ways of constructing our own world and responding to our own inner world, I wrote a paper about that, which did appear in Psychological Perspectives. You can find it there. Some thoughts about the last Renaissance. This was in another conference on the aging process. That was kind of a not funny, but I use that title because I wanted to make a point that there may be no last Renaissance, but only successive. Renaissance says. I think we could note in passing that something of the same thing happened in pretty much our own time when quantum physics made its appearance in Europe. Born essentially in the 20th century, although the forerunners of modern day quantum theory were talking about the preliminary ground of the ideas before that. It really blossomed in the late 19th and early 20th century. It was then, but now is playing an extraordinary role in transforming contemporary thinking and cultural dynamics. It's quite astonishing to think what happened in science in about 1905, when Albert Einstein published around that time his first revolutionary paper about space and time. Altogether new thinking about, you know, the green out there that we walk down in these days, the sidewalks, the hallways. Einstein saw all of that in a different way, and its relationship to time. You know, we all have time around.